Welcome to the Visible Policing Podcast, where we explore the nature and impact of the visual in relation to contemporary crime and policing.
I'm Liam Ralph, Research Fellow at Northumbria University, and I'm joined today by my colleague Dr. Tom Watson. Tom is a current lecturer in Media Studies, and his expertise is on film and the audio-visual media, and in particular, extreme media culture. So Tom, one area of yours that you look into is representations of violence. Can you tell us a little bit about what that entails?
So representations of violence is quite a broad spectrum of various things. So in terms of my research, or in terms of the research that I come up against, there's a lot of people who define media violence in different ways. So for my own research interest, that ventures or veers into sort of areas of horror cinema, especially kind of independent, more underground productions, which seem to have little compromise in terms of the depictions of violence that they can actually create. I'm also interested in underground music subcultures that tend to veer into areas of violence as well, and transgression, kind of going against what people might consider acceptable in more mainstream forms. So that's just kind of my broader research areas of interest, what I've published on, what I've written about in terms of projects, what I've been working on. They all seem to kind of come back around to areas of violence in some way.
So you said they're independent and underground. What do you mean by independent and underground then?
In terms of independent and underground, it might be those filmmakers that exist outside of the mainstream, like I kind of mentioned before. So not necessarily films that you're going to see in your local Odeon or whatever other multiplex that you might frequent. These might be films that are produced by niche filmmakers that might have their own production companies. They might finance their own films. They might use things like Kickstarter or crowdfunding platforms in order to get their films made. They tend to be fans of the genre and maybe situate themselves against what they might feel is a more sanitized version of horror cinema. So things like, I don't know, your found footage cycles, which emerge in the cinemas, obviously your torture porn movies, which are noted for their extremity, but you still get these filmmakers who might be conflating fabricated scenes of violence with actually people self-harming on screen as part of their performance. So you get these kind of more transgressive representations that do push the boundaries in terms of performance, in terms of aesthetics, and even in terms of subject matter as well. They don't tend to be very nice movies to watch, because there is often a conflation of sex and violence within them, but I think they are interesting to study from a point of performance and also film form. So that's kind of my take on those types of productions, I guess.
That's really interesting. So see, in terms of this kind of cult cinema that you're referring to there, do they tend to push the boundaries a little bit more than perhaps your mainstream films then?
I think when you're talking about cult films, I mean, they do seem to have this a cult following, whichever way that you might define that, in that you have maybe small audiences or smaller audiences who are interested in this type of product, because these films are obviously made to be seen by their audiences in whatever way that they might access that material. But I think it is quite interesting, because cult films do tend to exist, like I said, in opposition to a version of the mainstream, whatever way that might be defined as well. I'm not saying like all cult film is oppositional to the mainstream, because you could argue that something like Star Wars is a cult film in terms of its audiences or pockets of audiences which it produces. But the films I'm interested in, they do seem to sort of push boundaries in terms of what can and can't be shown, what can and can't be filmed, and it has led to certain films at various times being subject to either stricter regulations or, you know, if we're talking about films in a British context, certain cinema has been rejected classification by various bodies, governing bodies, so people don't necessarily have what you could consider legal access to this type of cinema or these types of media texts on home media, so things like DVD, Blu-ray, for example. So these films do tend to exist outside of those maybe other more dominant ways of access, I think.
So just because you kind of hinted at it there, the stricter regulations, does that exist for these kind of independent and underground films you're referring to then?
I think in terms of the films that I'm interested in that have been produced, and a lot of them are kind of these American, what's known as hardcore horror films. So these are films that tend to, like I said, conflate images of violence, images of sex, real instances of self-harm as performance art. It's very... The performers involved in these particular movies don't necessarily consider it exploitation because it is part of what they define as their art. So it kind of runs into trouble a lot in terms of this high art, low culture binary, which is still prevalent within the ways in which these films are distinguished. But for that reason, amongst other reasons as well, these are films that wouldn't necessarily get past governing bodies, certain, I don't want to say sensorial boards or censorship boards, but something like the BBFC in the UK at least. It's probably not worth filmmakers or distributors submitting these types of films because they wouldn't necessarily get a certificate. They wouldn't necessarily be able to be distributed in mainstream retail outlets. But of course, certain filmmakers have played with that. They've submitted films that they know maybe in advance aren't necessarily going to get a certificate because it creates controversy. So then you have marketing of these films like, oh, banned in the UK or banned in 37 different countries. So then it becomes, it's almost giving fans of those particular movies a shopping list with which to track down some of these examples.
And so can they still be shown? Can they still be... You can still see them, despite the fact that they've not went through these kind of...
There's certain legalities and legal grey areas around what can and can't be screened, because although the BBFC operates in terms of, you know, these ideas of what can be distributed, local councils also are involved in these processes as well. So, you know, what might be able to be screened in one borough, in one particular district, may or may not be able to be screened elsewhere. There's a lot of films like this do tend to be screened at specialist film festivals as well. So that might be a limited screening. There might be, you know, a Q&A with the director before this film fades into obscurity. But largely, you know, you can still order certain films through Amazon. You know, they might not necessarily have a certificate here in the UK, but you can order them from the US quite readily. You may get a cease and desist letter from Customs and Excise, but that might happen, it might not. But there are various formal and informal means, shall we say, of accessing this type of material.
And does that exist then for their audience then? They will go about, they will know how to get access. I mean, how do they know what's available then if it's...
Well, that's it as well, because you kind of, you know, you have your hardcore fans who will be able to, you know, access this type of material. And as well, like the filmmakers involved in these particular films, like I mentioned hardcore horror cinema before, it's not a massive genre. Like, it is this smaller kind of underground body of films. I guess you could sort of loosely define it as that. But the filmmakers are quite conversational and accessible to their fans, their audiences. Having done research in this area, you know, you've only got to contact someone via social media and they will readily either talk to you about a film. They might send you a screener copy. They might direct you to a social media platform or otherwise that actually hosts the film. A lot of these filmmakers might put something online that you can just watch. It's free. So they'd rather have people access this material and see their art, if you like, rather than having the monetary compensation that, you know, something like having it formally certified might produce.
So it's not necessarily for commercial goals these films will be created, but more to...
I think without necessarily speaking for filmmakers themselves, I do think obviously these films are made to produce or produce money for commercial gain in some respect. But they're definitely not seen by, you know, a mainstream audience. So I think the returns on this type of cinema, shall we say, these representations of violence, isn't necessarily going to be comparable to, you know, your films what you're going to access through your multiplex. Obviously, I think that's not necessarily something that's hidden. But I do think a lot of these filmmakers talk about the movies that they produce in terms of art. They do tend to talk about it in terms of offering fans of the genre something they wouldn't necessarily get elsewhere, because they have this lack of compromise in terms of what they film, what they show, how they justify these depictions, the types of performers they work with. So yeah, there's a lot of different interesting sort of factors involved here. So, I mean, some people might produce things because of the notoriety, so then people are going to be attracted to this. Or some people might be producing work which does present really interesting meditations on violence, how we receive violence, and how we read violence. And so, yeah.
You said the word transgression before, so what do you mean by transgression?
So in terms of transgression, I mean, this is a label that gets applied to a range of different texts, and I'm talking like texts in terms of the examples of audiovisual media that I'm interested in. So transgression for me, and this is a term that's came up a lot in my research, and I'm kind of working hard at the moment on various articles which try to unpick the semantics of transgression and how it's actually been applied or misapplied as a generic label to various films, because there is an argument that films, especially these niche undergrounds or cult films, are all transgressive in some way. Now, that might mean in terms of what they depict, it might mean in terms of the subject matter which they explore, or it might mean the practices which audiences involve themselves within in order to access this particular material. But that kind of delimits this term, because it makes everything this one homogeneous kind of mass, if you like. Because if everything's transgressive, that's a new norm that's being created. So how can things transgress if they are already transgressive? So it becomes this kind of circular motion, or an ebb and flow, like I like to think about it, about pushing against boundaries, questioning why they exist, highlighting what those boundaries are in order to bend them, break them, and then create new norms which can then be pushed against as well. Another thing that I just want to touch upon in terms of transgression is that it is temporally and culturally specific. So something which might be problematic at one point in time, that might be a film that's been censored for whatever reason, you might be able now to go in HMV, get your brand new Ultra Edition Blu-ray that has several commentaries, it might have several versions of that film, for a tenner. So that film that might have been banned in the 1980s, for example, you can now walk in and get a very, very interesting high-definition version of that, which might mean that transgression, or the transgressions that it's embodied at one point in time, aren't necessarily relevant on a contemporary basis. And there's numerous films that have had trajectory in the UK. I'm thinking of something like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is this kind of classic genre film, within horror or even exploitation cinema more broadly, which was rejected certification in the UK, and it wasn't until the early 2000s when the director at the time of the British Board of Film Classification, James Furman, passed away, that people reassessed that film amongst others, and then it was re-released in this sort of really reappraised version. So it's kind of, transgression is relative, I think, in terms of when we might perceive and deal with these particular media texts.
So when it's, so that film there, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, when it, so it hadn't received its certification, could people still view it then before it received its certification then? Was it something that was accessible to some?
Well, in that sense, so you have, you know, your cinematic release of the film, and you're talking the early 1970s for something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And that sort of segues quite nicely into video culture in Britain in the late 70s and the early 1980s, because at the time, video as a new medium was unregulated. So you had a range of films which were released via various companies. A colleague at Northumbria, Dr. Johnny Walker, could that's one of his research specialisms into this area. But generally, you have, like I said, unregulated material, unregulated content, which is coming into the market, this new technology of video. People don't necessarily know what it is, but amongst that you have various horror films which are released to video as well. Now, they might have carried various certificates in the cinema, but on video, they, as I said, unregulated, technically speaking, anyone could access the films that were released on video. Now, some of these films might have been slightly cut in the cinema, but they might be in their uncut versions on video. Now, this doesn't just relate to horror. Obviously, other material was available, like child or children's films, child cartoons and things like that were quite prevalent on video as well. But these were often, you know, placed together in the same shops with this other more violent content, if you like. So something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was on video, but it became embroiled to an extent in the video nasties moral panic of the early 1980s, whereby, you know, people viewed video as a threat. They viewed this unregulated boom in horror and exploitation cinema as a threat, which then led to quite knee-jerk responses in Parliament, the Conservative government pushing through what became known as the Video Recordings Act, or the VRA, in 1984-1985, which then resulted in a lot of these films becoming illegal for video shop owners to distribute or rent. And then what you have as a result of that, so you have the Director of Public Prosecutions having several drafts of various films which were illegal or viewed as problematic. Now, this changed quite frequently. You had various versions of this. But basically, various films which became illegal to rent, to obviously not necessarily own, but to be distributed, resulted in a lot of people being prosecuted, video shop owners being prosecuted for having these videos in stock. But then also what you get is tape trading, piracy, a lot of people recording or dubbing various problematic content on video, then that circulates as well. So you get a lot of fans, audiences accessing material that way, which again has continued in the digital age in terms of how people access particular content as well. So there's an interesting history, I guess, around this type of content, this type of media, and the ways in which people can access that. I do appreciate that that isn't necessarily a very specific history of the way in which that works, but that is a kind of broad overview of that era, if you like.
So you kind of hinted at there as well, people's views of violence over time. What do we know about that then? I mean, and where are we at just now then? We've made kind of 2 points there. So,
I mean, I think in terms of people's view of violence, I mean, you know, it is, people bring their very subjective interpretations to whatever that might be. Now, personally, I think it's fascinating to observe or try to quantify how audiences view certain material, how that's viewed as violent, if it is viewed as violent, what contexts it can be placed within, which kind of alters perceptions of how violence actually works. But for my own, in terms of my own interests, there seems to be this period every 10 years or so when you have a transgressive cinematic moment, if you like, whereby you might have certain films which emerge, which touch or break those kind of boundaries which might have been set before. So say, for example, in the 1980s, you have things like the Video Nasties, which were a range of different films from America, from Europe. There was a British example, a British kind of exploitation horror movie, Exposé, which was in there as well. You move into the early 1990s, you obviously have people like Quentin Tarantino, independent productions coming through, things like Reservoir Dogs. You have what people call the new brutalism in cinema, so how violence becomes something which is new, something which is different, something which is more visceral perhaps. And then moving beyond that, in the early 2000s, around 2001, you have something which is called the new French extremity, which is a group of films, French in origin, which again push the boundaries of violence, of sex, of taboo subject matter, things like incest, various other kind of issues around sex and sexual cultures, and that kind of proliferates into wider Europe. So you kind of do get these moments where you have something which is new, so new brutalism, new extremity, and so forth. So I think at the moment, we might be in a period which is building up to something else which is going to quantify this new idea of cinematic violence, I think, especially in terms of the development of technology and things like that.
And how do some of these films and movements perhaps become accepted and unaccepted? So what determines whether it's an accepted movement and it makes its way into screens type thing?
I mean, what you have in that sense then, especially with something like the new French Extremity that I mentioned, I think I mentioned earlier this idea that you have hierarchies of taste and value which might be attached to this type of content. So, for example, the new French Extremity might be made by auteur filmmakers, might be sort of certain filmmakers who have a high level of prestige, who are touching upon this taboo subject matter. It might be the case that they're viewed in art house cinemas, so there's a certain class-based element to the perceptions of who's actually watching this type of material. And then you get into discussions of, well, if these films, which are more quote-unquote arty, are acceptable, they are certified accordingly or they're critically appraised, but they might have similar subject matter or similar imagery to those which exists in vilified horror cinema, it then becomes an argument of, well, is it because middle class people or middle class audiences can tolerate or accept or be unaffected by the type of violence that they see in an arthouse cinema versus films that might be more accessible to general audiences, therefore need to be censored or kind of restricted a lot more severely because there is a fear that that's going to have a negative effect on the ways in which those audiences see and interpret that material. Now, that does seem to it does still seem to be a concern, this media effects argument of, you know, certain types of media having a damaging or negative impact on others. Like recently, for example, there's been a lot of debate around high school shootings in the US, and obviously rightly so, but the recent DC comic book movie Joker, for example, Joaquin Phoenix was asked in a recent interview to what extent did he think that the implications of violence in his film would therefore influence further violence within the context of those high school shootings. And there was a lot of controversy because he walked out of that interview. He didn't necessarily know what to say. He returned later on, but again, it just shows you that sort of same thinking around those types of arguments, what people can access this type of material, is still surfacing, which I think is really problematic.
And are the arguments the same over time? If you look at the Inception to now, when they talk about violence, do they make, and when it's problematized and when some people see it as the evil and the devil, is it the same arguments that they make over time, or is it a new form of violence that starts to come into it?
I think it is. There does seem to be this kind of recycling of arguments, especially when you get into terms of, you know, censorship or classification as it may be. Is known more officially, because there's still this rhetoric of protecting children from harm, whether that's in terms of psychological development or moral harm, whatever that means. It's kind of like, well, how do you define that? And there's also this idea, especially when we're talking about something like the BBFC. Now, their guidelines for certification historically, and I realise I'm kind of very focused on a British context here, which I guess is where my own research is focused, but it's obviously where I position myself. It's kind of my own experience of this. There's this really problematic rhetoric around protecting vulnerable adults. So this seems to be really ill-defined in the sense that people can't necessarily make decisions for themselves what they can and can't watch. And that seems to be at the expense of others. And I think some of the research around this, which you know, these governing bodies commissions, is really problematic as well in terms of some of the audience research that they do into the way in which these films are consumed. So you might get very few people interviewed. They might be watching these films in contexts that they wouldn't necessarily be watching them otherwise. There's this idea about active audiences who actually engage with this type of material anyway. Why aren't those people actually ask these questions, they're interested audiences? So there's a lot of research that has been done that maybe contravenes some of the official decisions which are made, but at the same time, it is these kind of arguments, this idea of protecting children from harm, protecting vulnerable adults, which does seem to still surface. It does still seem to hold weight. Now, that might be directed at different texts, but it is that kind of, or those myths, if you like, which do still surface.
So it's the same arguments that are made over time there then. Who are on these censorial boards then? So as someone who's not involved in film and media, what is a censorial board then? What does it look like?
I mean, in terms of the BBFC, I mean, they used to...
What does that stand
for? So the BBFC is the British Board of Film Classification. Now, historically, they used to be called the British Board of Film Censors. Now, that shift was made to classification because they believe, and a lot of people believe, and I'm not bashing the BBFC because I think the job that they do is perhaps quite difficult. I don't think it's an easy task that they are faced with in terms of what they have to do. But at the same time, this idea of classifying, giving public guidance in terms of, you know, film and television, that is their role. That is something what they do, at least in a British context. Now, people would argue that the BBFC as an institution, as a regulatory body, if you like, is obsolete or becoming obsolete in the face of how people actually consume audiovisual media, whether that's streaming platforms, whether that's downloading things, how online media can't necessarily or shouldn't necessarily be regulated in the same way. Like, you can't necessarily control the internet because, you know, the various debates around that, we could do another podcast about that. But as I understand it, the BBFC, for example, is a small group of officers that you'll have your directors, you'll have various people on the board who watch various types of films, various types of television. Their day might be made up watching the latest Sylvester Stallone Rambo, for example, in the morning, and that might be followed by watching, I don't know, 3 to 4 episodes of something like Peppa Pig in the afternoon to assess who it's relevant for, how it should be certified, and so forth. Now, the argument is, why should there be a very small number of people from a range of backgrounds, whether that's, you know, they might have came from the industry, they might come from other work, other jobs. Why should it be that a small group of people effectively makes these decisions? Now, obviously, certain decisions can be appealed. There have been various cases in the past, historically, whereby decisions that have been made around certain films have been overturned, and they've went through legal proceedings and so forth, they've been reassessed. But it is still that kind of idea that you have maybe 10 to 12 people from different walks of life, different experiences, like I say, but effectively they're making the decisions on how a film is officially classified in terms of cinema release, in terms of home video release, DVD, Blu-ray and so forth. And they have also been part of decisions made in the past around video games, when it was their responsibility to classify video games, computer games, in whatever forms they were in the past. I don't necessarily think they have as heavy hand in doing that anymore, but they're also in talks with and kind of had trials whereby with certain internet content providers, the BBFC might offer their services in terms of classifying certain content online. So their grip is maybe viewed quite cynically now in terms of what responsibilities they actually have or whether or not people actually listen to the advice that they get, because it is framed and marketed as, you know, customer advice. We advise you that this film is going to contain X, Y, and Z, therefore, you know, we've excised this particular scene for this particular reason. But yeah, that is kind of how it's made up. In an American context, you have the Motion Picture Association of America, which is very different. They don't seem to be historically as open or transparent as the BBFC has perhaps set itself up as being. They do seem to make decisions behind closed doors, maybe within consultation with directors and so forth. But there are various documentaries which have been released around that particular regulatory body, if you like. And that obviously differs from something like the Australian Board of Film Classification. So it does depend, I think. There isn't any one-size-fits-all approach.
And do they come under pressure then? Do they ever come under pressure from either the public, from politics, these kind of organisations? Or
I do think they come under pressure, and they have historically came under pressure. So say, for example, we'll go back to the BBFC. Now, I've mentioned something like the Video Nasties in the 1980s, but we also have an implication of public responsibility. I think if we look at the early 1990s, something like the James Bulger murder, which you had violent video content embroiled in that particular discussion, whereby that accusation or sort of assumption was made that the young boys who were responsible for the murder of James Bulger were influenced to do the acts that they did because they'd watched Child's Play 3 on video. Whether or not they had, I don't think has been necessarily been proven. It was found that one of the child's stepfathers had that in his possession. But then you have debates, you have parliamentary debates around violent video content, you have various decisions which are then made. So the BBFC is tasked with becoming this kind of regulatory body, which I don't think does necessarily exist as independent as what it would like to think it does from things like the government and the various political pressures which might be placed on it to act in certain ways. Whether that is prevalent now as what it has been in the past, I don't think that is necessarily the case, but I do think there's a relationship there that needs to be questioned.
That's interesting. So was it Child Play? Child Play 3?
Child's Play 3, yes. Yeah. So you have this franchise. It's the third installment. You have this killer doll, Chucky, which obviously makes a reappearance every Halloween. I mean, there's various sequels have been made since. But it was the circumstances of James Bulger's death, the various acts which were reported to have been sort of vested upon him, shared certain similarities allegedly with scenes in the film. So I think the prosecuting judge at the time did make a very bold statement in that video or violent videos were to blame for this particular crime. I mean, that seemed to have been a myth that has been pervasive, especially around how that particular crime has been looked upon, how it's resurfaced, the various reduxes of that argument again and again. So yeah.
So some really important and insightful conversation there. Tom, thanks very much for contributing to our podcast.
That's no problem at all, mate. I really appreciate being asked.
This podcast is produced as part of an Economic and Social Research Council funded study, Visible Policing. For more information, visit visiblepolicing.com.